Today on Straight Talk Africa, more on the challenges of political transitions in Africa, an announcement regarding the Sierra Leonean presidential runoff between Brigadier Julius Maada Bio and Dr. Samura Kamara is expected sooner rather than later. And in the southern African nation of Botswana, there is a peaceful transfer of power and a new president in the capital, Habarone. While in Ethiopia and Egypt, new rulers have been chosen in Addis Ababa and Cairo, respectively. That's coming up next right here on Straight Talk Africa. Hello, welcome to Straight Talk Africa, live from the Voice of America headquarters here in Washington. I am Shaka Sali.
And hello to all our viewers and listeners on the continent and elsewhere. I'm Esther Githui-Ewart, your social media reporter.
Today, we are continuing with our discussion on the challenges of political transitions in Africa.
And coming up later, our audience has weighed in on our topic through emails, Facebook and Twitter comments, and we'll reveal some of them ahead on Straight Talk Africa.
Many African nations are holding presidential and general elections this year as part of democratic transitions on the continent. My colleague Paul Sisco has more, and we warn you, this story contains a graphic image.
Sierra Leoneans are anxiously awaiting an election commission announcement to see who won the presidential runoff. Supporters of the opposition Sierra Leone People's Party say they're convinced Brigadier Julius Maada Bio has won the contest, but a spokesman for the ruling All People's Congress says that its candidate, Samura Kamara, is ahead based on the most recent tabulation of ballots cast. So far, each candidate is agreeing to abide by the National Electoral Commission's tallying system and not undermining the results process. An announcement from the commission is expected soon. It has been delayed several days due in part to fraud complaints. Maada Bio and Kamara are competing to replace outgoing President Ernest Bai Koroma, who is not allowed to run for re-election due to constitutional term limits. Sierra Leone's largely peaceful election process is a relief for the West African nation of 7 million people, which endured a brutal diamond-fueled civil war in the 1990s. The country's next president will be under pressure to revive an economy ravaged in recent years by low prices for its main export, iron ore, and a devastating Ebola outbreak, which killed nearly 4,000 people. Election observers from the EU, AU, and elsewhere say there was a large, peaceful turnout for the vote, more peaceful than the campaign period, marred by tribalism fears. Mustafa Y is president and CEO of Mamba TV.
The EU put out reports. The election was relatively free and fair and credible. Of course, they raised a couple of issues regarding the over-militarization of the election process, the presence of police at polling stations, and also cited numerous attacks on the election commission from both parties.
He says officials of the ruling party have posted that John Mahama, former president of Ghana and chair of the Commonwealth Observer Group, was kicked out of the country for meddling on behalf of the British government, a falsehood Mahama denies vehemently. In Botswana, a new president was sworn in Sunday. He is the landlocked country's fifth post-colonial leader, retired teacher Mogoetsi Masisi. He takes over from former Army General Ian Khama. He inherits a nation with a reputation as one of Africa's rare political and economic success stories. Moving to the Horn of Africa, Ethiopia's parliament and ruling party swore in Abiy Ahmed as its 12th prime minister Monday. Ethiopia's third prime minister in 23 years is promising democratic reforms aimed at ending 3 years of increasing unrest by diffusing ethnic tensions in the Oromia province. Abiy is Oromo, the largest ethnic group in Ethiopia and the wider Horn of Africa. Ahmed, a former Army Lieutenant General, replaces Haile Mariam Desalegn, who stepped down in February amid nationwide civil and political unrest. In Egypt, a whopping 97% of the presidential votes cast were for incumbent Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, deepening his grip on the North African nation and the Arab world's most populous country. Egypt is also a key U.S. ally. Critics say al-Sisi's consolidation of power has been marked by an alleged wide-scale repression and targeting of opponents. They also say he arrested or pushed out all credible opponents. Supporters are already pushing to change presidential term limits that would allow al-Sisi to remain in power past his new term. Paul Sisko, VOA News, Washington.
Thanks, Paul, for that interesting report. We'll have more on Africa's democratic transitions in a moment. But first, we want to begin with a remembrance of Winnie Madikizela Mandela, who died Monday at 81, surrounded by family at her home in South Africa. Following a long illness, she fought valiantly against the apartheid state and sacrificed her life for the freedom of the country. During his years in prison on Robben Island, she kept her husband Nelson Mandela's light alive, campaigning tirelessly at home and abroad for the cause and his release, and was herself jailed and tortured by the apartheid state. The African National Congress Women's League says she will forever remain one of the outstanding activists of our time and the embodiment of our African values for the emancipation of women. She was a selfless fighter of the unjust laws of oppression against the poor and the working class, and earned her the title of Mother of the Nation. Winnie and Nelson Mandela divorced in 1996. They had two children together. Our heartfelt sympathies go out to her family and friends and to the people of South Africa. May her eternal soul rest in peace. Joining us here are two distinguished guests. Mustafa Wai, founder and host of Mamba Online Television. Among other things, he also previously served as a deputy director for quality assurance at NASA. And Mohamed Ademo, founder and editor of Pride.com, an independent news website about Ethiopia. He also previously worked as an assistant opinion editor at Al Jazeera America. I have to say, Mustafa and Mohamed, that I am profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host the two of you on Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you.
And in your particular case, of course, Mustafa, for the first time.
Thank you.
You're most welcome. Later in the program, we'll give our audience a chance to call in with your question or comment. The number to call is 202-619-3111. The US country code is 1. Now, Mustafa, when you talk about Winnie Madikizela Mandela, what is your immediate reaction, really, when you hear that name?
The first thing that comes to mind is freedom fighter. A lot of people want us to remember her that, and I think a lot of us were very young when the apartheid struggle was happening in South Africa and we listened to radio. So that's really what we remember, freedom fighter. But I'd also want people to also know that she was a family member. She was a mother. And in such a trying times when her husband was imprisoned, she basically had two children to care for. And just you can imagine in such a difficult trying times for her to be able to raise children by herself in the absence of her husband, and also be able to deal with the emotions of having your husband in prison. So for me, it's a strong fighter and also a very strong mother.
What about you, Mohamed? In fact, in your particular case, when you heard about her death Monday, what was your immediate reaction?
Thanks for inviting me back, Shaka. It's always good to see you. I think my initial reaction was Winnie embodies the spirit of a strong African woman. She was as fierce and as she was defiant. And the apartheid state tried to break her spirit by taking away her husband at a young age, and also, of course, taking her and putting her in jail. And they did everything they could to stop her, including feeding all kinds of rumors and things into the press and even sending messages to Mandela himself to sort of ruin their relationship. So at that time, you know, when she was in the struggle, a lot of the African freedom leaders who came to power after independence happened to be mostly men, and she stands out as this strong African woman who was raising children, fighting for her husband's release, and was also fighting to free her country from the scourge of apartheid. So it was really, she had a truly remarkable life as a freedom fighter, and I was sad to hear that she had departed.
Would you agree with some who have suggested that she taught all of us that you didn't, in fact, have to have an AK-47, you didn't have to have a gun, and that, in fact, you didn't need to be a man?
Absolutely.
To struggle for freedom.
Absolutely. Again, you know, she, you look at the timing and you look at the forces that she was up against. And in the society at that time, you know, things are much more progressive in the continent and also around the world in terms of women's rights and women's place in society. And at that time, for her to stick her neck out and risk all of that, not just for herself, but for her children, and fight for the cause and stay with it until the last days of her life is truly remarkable.
Muhammad, how do you respond to those who seem to be focused or concentrating on the downside, the negative part of Winnie Mandela, especially her role of, you know, being involved in situations that involved quote-unquote necklacing, for example?
Well, I think you have to really understand her entire life and the struggle and the atmosphere under which she lived at that time to be able to appreciate the sort of pressure that they, you know, that she was under as a leader of a movement, a popular movement, if you will, for their country, and also popular movement elsewhere at that time, to be able to make sense of the options that were there in terms of choices to make. And there are very few that were popular, you know, at a time in the minds of people that were not probably feeling exactly what she was struggling with. So I think people have to pay more attention to the positive side of the end, sort of justifying the means of what the struggle was about. And ultimately, then the greater world ended up embracing what came out of all of that.
What about the African aspect of culture, which almost suggests that if someone passes away, you definitely have to celebrate their accomplishments and what have you. You really don't have to go to the negative part.
Correct.
Of whatever they were part of.
Correct. That's a very popular African culture. That don't speak ill of the dead. I mean, I'm sure it's a culture that it's accepted, it's expected across Africa, and I think not only Africa, but even in the West, you know, you don't hear people at eulogy, you know, giving bad, you know, saying bad things about the person that passed away. So it's always the memorable good things. And you let the bad things, you know, it's you celebrating that person, you know, death. So it's celebration. So celebration, it means good news, good information, and the good things you remember about that person. So I think that's where the focus should be.
Muhammad, there have been some reports suggesting that she very, very strongly criticized her former husband, the late Nelson Mandela, the Madiba, for his approach. In fact, she went to the extent of saying that the Madiba actually sold out, that he cut a very bad deal for the indigenous Africans of South Africa. Was he justified?
I think essentially that criticism, that bold stance, exemplifies who she was. She was not a kind of person who would simply just get in line. She was independent in her thoughts and then also in her courage. And she clearly had a different vision for post-apartheid South Africa than Mandela and some of the people in her party. And I think some of the things that she was saying in terms of economic liberation of South African, black South Africans in this case, if you look at the history of African National Congress post-apartheid, you could say that there have been political freedom in the sense that South Africa is relatively more free in open society. But when you talk about poverty and black people not getting their fair share of the deal in terms of economic emancipation, that economic message is really essentially what is now fueling the EFF movement by Julius Malema, who was Jacob Zuma's former ally and had a fallout. And that message that Mandela gave too much ground and that he was focused more on bringing this country together, creating a rainbow nation, as opposed to redressing some of the complex, very challenging things that they fought against. And again, you know, Winnie was a very complex figure, and no one leader is perfect. And people tend to point out the bad things that she was allegedly involved in. But truth of the matter is, what apartheid did to South Africa and the people of South Africa is unconscionable. And I think when people talk about some of these allegations, they have to keep in mind that they were up against a system that was in place essentially to keep the people of South Africa, especially black South Africans in this case, repressed and be governed by a white minority.
Would you agree that apartheid was a system like Jim Crow that was, in fact, to a large extent, dehumanizing?
Absolutely. It's not that it was not only was it dehumanizing, but they also had control of the land and control of everything. And these were indigenous lands, and the people who were on this land, and you know, these are other people coming out from outside of the country, taking over, setting a system in place that not only dehumanized them, but they essentially was meant to cleanse them and keep them relegated to the periphery. So absolutely, I think it's a fair analogy.
You know, Mustafa, Winnie was an incredible and remarkable human being. Despite her privileges, really, she could have lived anywhere, in Johannesburg, for example, or Cape Town, or that kind of stuff. But you know, she actually stayed in Soweto, the southwestern township of Johannesburg. And I remember, frankly, being humbled, paying a courtesy call at her residence in Orlando, the part of Soweto, in 2009, and had lunch in her restaurant, actually, in Soweto, which is next to the original House of Mandela, which is now a museum. You can't believe she still, you know, stayed with her people.
Right.
Ordinary people.
Right.
What kind of lessons do you learn from that?
It's the commitment she had to our people was what really drove her into activism to begin with. And we got to keep in mind that she spent a lot more time with the people of South Africa, much more than her husband did while he was in prison. And so she lived the era and felt the suffering of the people, felt the struggle that the people were going through. And it embodies her, who she was. So when you mention Soweto, Soweto is an icon of the struggle. I mean, a lot of what we've read about the struggle, Soweto always was mentioned. You know, the struggle of apartheid in South Africa cannot be completed without the mentioning of Soweto. So that wasn't a surprise at all when she decided to live there. And she was always wanted to be with her people. And when you lead people in a struggle and you succeed, you know, it's time to still stay with them. You know, you've seen instances where people go away and then they lose touch of what really started this whole struggle, and they lose touch of what the issues were, you know, what the feelings were, who was affected. She always remained there with the people, and she understood that. And that's probably where her frustration was coming from, because she wanted to see the change so fast. And we got to keep in mind that apartheid lasted for a very long time. So the indifferences that took place during that period, and to just overturn that overnight, it's not gonna happen. It's a gradual process. And I think Mandela understood that much more than she did, because of how she lived it and the hopes of this, of South Africans. And a lot of people were hoping that it's gonna change overnight. And then, like Mohammed said, freedom comes, political freedom comes, and then economic empowerment comes. And there's no easy answers to some of these questions, like the land issues that are happening now in South Africa. I mean, if you go back in history and look at how it was acquired, and then those that are trying to take it back have a basis for their for their decision, for what they're asking for. It may appear unreasonable at this point in time, but if you go back in history and really try to deeply understand how it was acquired to the first place, not only the land should come back, maybe there are some other additional compensation that should come with the land. If you look at the intrinsic value of what has been gone for so long. But I'm not saying it's an overnight decision. It's a very difficult decision for the people of South Africa. And they got to keep in mind that South Africa now is both for blacks and white. And those who have been living on this land, by extension now, are all part of, you know, South Africa, and they all own it. So the process of having an equitable distribution of that should be one that doesn't affect one group, you know, against the other.
I know, of course, Mohammed, you come from Ethiopia. You were never colonized, at least by the Western powers. Did you, in some way or form, get inspired by the contributions of a Winnie Mandela fighting against apartheid in South Africa for your particular case in Ethiopia?
I was obviously young and didn't much of the things that I know about the anti-apartheid struggle and about Winnie is from reading and learning about it in school.
And the people you talk with who happened to live at the time?
Absolutely, yeah. But I think one thing, Ethiopia and South Africa had these linkages during the period of the struggle where Mandela's first military training itself took place in Ethiopia under the leadership of very prominent Ethiopian generals who themselves went on to fight against a monarchy. And were killed eventually in the process of the struggle.
Under the leadership, of course, of Emperor Haile Selassie.
Haile Selassie, yes. Mm. So in that sense, I think the thread is, I think the most common thread in my conversations and something that really stands out for me is Winnie was truly original and she stayed true to her roots, staying in Soweto, as you mentioned, and also staying close to the demands of the people and what people really sacrificed so much for. So in that sense, there's a lot of talk in Ethiopia where after the emperor fell, and a lot of people fought against that in some ways similar oppression, but not obviously comparable. A lot of people just went about, about their business and joined government and things like that, and others were killed. But Winnie sticks to the message and sticks to the struggle and had differences with her comrades. In that sense, I think staying true to your roots and the struggle and the people, I think that resonates with me very much.
Very interesting. She reminds me a bit of one great African-American intellectual and activist, Angela Davis.
Yes.
Who used to teach at UCLA, University of California, Los Angeles, on the west side of Los Angeles, and yet she would actually be living with her people in Crenshaw, near University of Southern California. Very interesting. Yeah. Let me ask you a question, Mohammed, about the latest from Freetown. If we may now move on to something else.
Okay. As I was walking into this room, the latest that I got from Freetown is that the last set of certified results from the last district that was pending just came in. And quite interestingly, this time around, the elections were conducted as such that there was a court order that was issued to mandate the certification of results at the district level and have that manually basically transported into the capital for final tallying. So basically everyone has the certified results from the district, and we all know who the winner is at this point before NEC is going out to announce. And I don't think anyone expects any surprises at this point.
Would it be fair to say that the apparent winner, at least so far from what you know, may probably be Brigadier General Julius Maada Bio?
That's correct. Based on the satisfied results that we have, you know, in our possession, including the ones that I've been gathering all day, and the last one that just came through, yes, the opposition SLPP, led by the candidates, is Julius Maada Bio, the retired Brigadier General. Is actually his leading by over 70,000 votes by our calculation. Mm-hmm. So presumptively, you could say he's the winner. And I mean, you can tell, I've been feeding on social media feeds as I was coming to the studio, and ruling party members out there, those who have been very vocal, are beginning to sort of, you know, concede defeat, you know, and sort of comment in a reconciliatory, you know, tone, basically. And this is very interesting. You know, hopefully this is going to be a very peaceful end, because it's been a very interesting couple of weeks. Sierra Leone, as you can imagine, with all the things that have been taking place from the first round of elections to the runoff that took place on March 31st.
What makes Maada Bio tick? I know that you attended American University with him. Is that correct?
That's correct.
He and I also used to be neighbors, really, in Arlington.
Okay.
And he appeared on several of my programs in the 90s before he went back to Freetown.
Right.
What kind of guy is he? Because I probably don't know him any longer, because really we haven't met or talked in many, many years.
Right. I went to college with him, just like you said, here at American University, up the street from where we are. A very quiet guy. I spent some time with him on campus, and I also spent some time with him, off campus, mainly around the 2012 election when he ran. I was in Sierra Leone around that time. He's a very quiet guy. I mean, from a military background, he's very disciplined. Sometimes people say he's very quiet to a fault. Mm. I mean, you sit around him, you say four or five things before he says one word.
Nice.
Sometimes some people are very uneasy with that. They become very uncomfortable if people are not speaking up a lot. But he listens a lot, and it's a big strength of his. Of course, you know, he has a history in the country, and a lot of people look at that because of the perception about military coups and things like that. But the coup that he was involved in 1992, the first coup, was a very popular one. And even
the one led by Strasser.
Correct. Mm-hmm. And the second one that happened in 1996 was also one, according to his own explanation and some of the things that we've heard, was to facilitate a smooth transition to a multi-party democracy, because our country was coming. That was for the first time in over 27 years, Sierra Leone was going to accommodate the multi-party democracy and have elections. Of course, the country was at war, and there were challenges around that time as well.
And of course, unlike, for example, Flight Lieutenant John Jerry Rawlings, retired but not tired, who pulled, of course, a coup in 1979 in Ghana, if I remember, and paved the way for democratic elections.
Right.
But 2 years later, he actually comes back.
Right.
And overthrows the democratically elected president. But in this particular case, this particular Maada Bio actually did not.
Right.
So does it look like the people of Sierra Leone probably are paying him back, really, for the good job done?
Right. And I think a lot of people tend to remember that. And, you know, there's a U.S. Congresswoman, Nancy Kassebaum, that actually made a comment when Bio handed over power in 1996.
You mean the former senator?
Right.
Yes.
And she said up to the moment that he turned over, they were not expecting that he was going to hand over power. And around that time in Africa, most military rulers that came to power through military coup were not, you know, they would tell you it's 3 months, 4 months, 6 months, and then things happen, and we're going to have elections, and then they'll postpone it, and then the next thing you look, they're a candidate in the elections. So a lot of Sierra Leoneans, especially supporters of Bio, they refer to him as the father of democracy, and that's because they felt like, you know, he actually had the option of doing what Yahya Jammeh did in Gambia and others in the sub-region that had come to power through the military coup, but he decided that he was going to have elections and hand over power. Now, critics would tell you that he was forced to do that. But, you know, when there's a war in the country and you have a gun, I mean, not many people can force you to do something, right? So, I mean, it can be argued, but that's why he's popular. He's so popular in the country by those who support him, and that's the number one argument, that he's the father of democracy. He handed over power for the first time in a multi-party democratic election in over 20-something years.
And then he humbled himself, of course, and went back to school.
Correct.
That's went when to college and got a couple of degrees.
Correct. That's when he came over to America here, and that's when we met here in the U.S., and he went to American University, finished his undergrad, and went straight to grad school, and got a master's degree here from American University.
Very interesting. Well, before pausing for a short break, we want to remind you that Straight Talk Africa is now streaming live on Facebook. To watch our show, just enter the keyword Straight Talk Africa, and don't forget to share it with your friends. We are on Twitter and we are tweeting live. Follow us at VOA Shaka, that's VOA Shaka, and join in on today's discussion with your questions and comments. Don't forget to use the hashtag VOA Africa Elections, and we'll comment later in the show. We'll be right back, so please, don't go away.
We are able to touch on things that are important to people on an everyday basis. We hope that our viewers are getting inspired when they watch our show. They're getting a view of the world from a different perspective, things that perhaps are not in their immediate vicinity. Today, I could put in on the show something that is a little different, a little unique, and this gives me that inspiration to come to work.
This is Straight Talk Africa on the Voice of America. What is your opinion about today's topic? Call us at 202-619-3111. U.S. country code 1. When you call, remember the following. Ask only one question. Keep your comment brief and turn down the volume on your radio or television. Now let's return to Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you very much, Esther Githui-Ewart, and of course, welcome back to Straight Talk Africa, live from Washington. It's time to bring in our social media reporter, Esther Githui-Ewart. Take it away, Esther.
Thank you, Shaka. We've received excellent social media feedback this week. The continent has a bevy of ongoing election situations and changes as heads of state, including Egypt, Ethiopia, Botswana, and Sierra Leone. This leads us to our question of the week, which asked, how do you feel about Africa's democratic process following recent presidential elections across the continent? And we're going to start with a tweet from Opano Godfrey, who tweets, the democratic process in Africa is still undemocratic because most of the electoral commissions are appointed by same presidents who are candidates in the same elections. When Africa takes one step ahead, it reverses five steps backwards. We have lost direction. And we have another tweet from Duke Mungero Ahmed, who says Africa's democratic process has receded in recent years. The incumbent always has an upper hand in the elections, right from the uncontrolled use of state machinery to bribe the electorate. The money is also used to frustrate the opposition. He says this is worse in my country, Uganda. Now to our social media comment of the week from a Facebook fan, Felix Nkendo Ekie, who writes, the democratic process in the continent is in rapid decline. We have cases of the incumbent winning 94% of the votes, like in Rwanda. In Ethiopia, the opposition could not win even a seat. In many countries, the state machinery is entrenched to rig elections. Good democratic process does not guarantee development. However, he says it guarantees sustainability. And let's go to another comment from a Facebook fan, Ramugema Paul, who writes, democracy in Africa is misunderstood and leaders in power think they are the yardstick for determining democracy. And our last Facebook comment comes from Ambassador Eric Palop Collins, who writes, Africa is actually getting on course. Liberia and Sierra Leone are reasons to convince us that we're ready to unite as a continent to collectively achieve the 2030 agenda of the Sustainable Development Goals. A reminder that we appreciate all of the audience feedback. If you're a new fan, drop us a line at africatv@voanews.com. To comment on our Facebook page, just enter the keywords Straight Talk Africa. Be sure to visit us online at voaafrica.com. To join our YouTube channel, sign up to VOA TV Africa. Follow us on Twitter at VOA Shaka. Straight Talk Africa streams live every Wednesday on Facebook, or simply go to VOA Straight Talk Africa TV program page on our website. To watch us live on your mobile device, download the VOA mobile app. And now let's look at what's on tap for next week's program. On the next Straight Talk Africa, politicians, rights activists and supporters worldwide are paying tribute to South African anti-apartheid campaigner Winnie Madikizela Mandela, who died on April 2nd at 81. A former wife of Nelson Mandela, Winnie was a prominent member of the ruling African National Congress Party and a member of the South African Parliament at the time of her death. She is mostly remembered as a fierce fighter against the white minority rule in South Africa. But she was not without her controversies. An in-depth discussion on Winnie Mandela on the next Straight Talk Africa. And well, that's all for today's social media segment. Shaka, you and the guests have a lot to discuss from these social media comments. Back to you.
Well, thanks, Esther. And today, of course, we are continuing on our conversation on the challenges of political transitions in Africa. Our guests are Mustafa Wai, founder and host of Mamba Online Television, and Mohammed Ademo, founder and editor of opride.com, an independent news website about Ethiopia. I have to say again that Mustafa and Mohammed, I am profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host you on Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Very interesting. You seem to be having names that seem to come from the same origins, yeah?
Correct.
Very interesting.
It's actually, my name is the beloved to his name.
I see.
That's the meaning.
Now, Muhammad, of course, you are not at least a descendant of the prophet, are you?
No, I'm not at all.
I see.
Yes.
Now, let's talk about your reaction to what you just heard. And of course, take us to Addis Ababa. We have a new kid on the block.
Yes, absolutely. I think I'm glad that you had Mustafa on. Sierra Leone is very important. West Africa has seen some kind of resurgence. You see Burkina Faso, you see the Gambia, and now Sierra Leone. And there are positive trends. Of course, there are
Liberia.
Bad spots. Liberia, of course. And there are bad spots like DRC and others, but...
That is Central Africa.
Yes.
By no means West Africa.
West Africa, I stand corrected. But that part of Africa has seen some movement towards more democratization and opening up, and certainly not something you can compare to the eastern side of Africa.
Eastern and Central and North Africa.
And North Africa. So I'm glad that, I hope that the transition will be complete and it will be free of the sort of post-election turbulences that we've seen in other countries, because as you've indicated, Sierra Leone obviously has a history of bad things happening in the past. And I think with the economy the way it is, and I hope that a lot of people are watching this, and I'm glad that it is also getting some coverage in the
Definitely.
International media. I'm very hopeful for your country. Now, back to Ethiopia, we've had a slightly different kind of election. So the people of Ethiopia did not actually vote in a new leader. So what ended up happening was there were 4 years of protests where protesters were demanding more democracy, more freedom, and the protests came back in vengeance after the last election in 2015, where the ruling party won 100% of the seats.
Yes.
So the new
American administration and Obama then, at least if I remember correctly, characterized it as 100% democracy.
Yes. And President Obama, of course, went to Ethiopia and referred to the process shortly afterward as a democratically elected government, which offended and disappointed a lot of Ethiopians, because he's really seen as a positive influence on African leaders by virtue of his heritage and his rhetoric on democracy and what have you. So this new prime minister is one of the 100% parliamentarians who were elected in the 2015 election. So what happened, though, after...
Were those elections? Would you really call those elections, or were they what some characterize as selections?
Well, these are just sporadic elections that the government does to tell the external forces, external governments and donors...
The development partners.
Yes, the development partners, that we are holding elections. But were these fair and free elections and credible elections? Completely not. I mean, the last time we've seen 100% of... seats being controlled or won by one party was Saddam Hussein's Iraq or countries like North Korea. Now we've seen it in Egypt and other places, of course, but that was truly, it angered a lot of people, and that's why you saw the relentless protest where the people of Ethiopia have said enough. But I think to their credit, though, is the government understood that they cannot continue on this trajectory. They needed to make change. This new prime minister was elected in 2016 to represent as the deputy chairman of the Oromia Regional State, Oromia being the largest state in Ethiopia, and then also where a lot of the anti-government protests was taking place. So when he was elected, one of the first things he did was the grievances about lack of democracy, the incarceration of opposition leaders, repression on journalists, and all these things are legitimate and credible, and we needed to make change. And some of the things that he did change was, as the board chair of the regional broadcaster, he allowed reporters to do investigative journalism on land deals and displacement of farmers from land, and then also corruption and the forced displacement of now 1.3 million people from the border with Somalia. So those things really endeared him to the protesters and the people who are demanding change. And for that reason and that reason alone, people see him as a reformer, a complete outsider. And this perception of him as a new, hopefully, progressive and reformist leader is enforced by the fact that the establishment, the military and security establishment, campaigned relentlessly against his election and made sure that until the 11th hour, he did not win. But he overcame those challenges, and he gave a very inspiring, hopeful speech. But it remains, now the question remains, would they allow him to put these changes that he enumerated to work? That we will have to wait and see.
Well, you allege that the military and security forces seem to have didn't seem to like him. How can they not possibly like one of theirs, really, a former lieutenant general?
That is the irony. He was a lieutenant general, and not only that.
Very high up in intelligence.
In intelligence. He was an intelligence officer, a director, and then deputy director of the National Intelligence Branch that controls information or information technology. But the thing is, his message is different from the status quo. He's saying we either change or go down. And
does he really have a choice, or does anybody, in fact, in his shoes have a choice? Because it's not only the uprisings, frankly, in Oromia or in the Amhara region and all kind of stuff, but we are also talking about the Renaissance Dam project, which obviously makes people very uncomfortable in Cairo.
Yes. Absolutely. I think the conundrum here is the problem the establishment is having. Yes, he's one of their own, but his message is different. And as you know, the military intelligence is controlled by the minority ethnic group from Tigray.
6% of the population.
6% of the population. And of course, when an Oromo, the majority, comes to power, and they are heavily invested in the economy, there is so much at stake for them. Not only just losing political power and control and influence over these key institutions of government, but also the economy. Their interests will be affected. So I think if he means what he says, he will need to tread very carefully so that he doesn't upset the balance too quick and things will arrival and it will end up with a military kind of government as we've seen in Egypt, where Mohamed Morsi was swept to power on the back of the Tahrir Square movement.
Yes.
But when Sisi came to power, of course, this was a military pushing back, because as in Ethiopia, the military in Egypt was involved in the economy and it also controlled these key institutions. So that's something we have to watch for. But in terms of his economic message, based on his speech yesterday on Renaissance Dam and growth and transformational plan, the developmental state, it seems like he will maintain some or all of those policies of the ruling party. But ultimately, would he be constrained within the democratic centralism, within the EPRDF platform, or can he push the envelope as he did in Oromia and challenge these entrenched military and security interests? Because he has the power that comes from the office of the prime minister being the commander in chief, but also
not
the power that comes from the support
chief, really,
that he
because
has.
Don't forget that you have a president, a head of state, who also happens to play that role, commander in chief of the armed forces. Your prime minister is head of government.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. I think he has a lot of advantages. But the most important advantage he has, leverage that he has on this against the establishment, is his support. His popular support cuts across ethnic divides. So it's not just the Oromo that are backing him. The Amharas are backing him. And the Southern Nations Coalition also voted for him. And with his speech, he broadened his appeal. And one of the things that, as I've said on this program before, the government lacks legitimacy. And this guy is about the only thing that provides legitimacy for this government. But for now, what we have is his speech and the rhetoric of change. And ultimately, he has to put that to action by sitting down with the opposition, releasing the political prisoners, and most importantly, lifting the state of emergency, which not only takes away his civilian powers, but also takes away all the democratic rights that he talked about in his speech. So you can talk all you want about democracy, but if the state of emergency suspends constitutional rights, there is no democracy to talk of.
He has to open up the essentially the political space, really.
Yes.
And he also has to be in a position, frankly, to deliver, to provide service delivery, correct?
Absolutely, yes.
Something that people can touch and feel.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, Ethiopia is a young country, and there are a lot of young people who need jobs, opportunities, access to government jobs. And as over the last 27 years, the practice has been you have to be a member of the ruling party or know someone connected to the ruling party to get the basic lowest paying job. He needs to change those things and give people opportunities and a say in government and a say in the future of the country.
Mohammed, I know that you probably won't like this because you happen to be a nationalist, an Ethiopian nationalist, and probably, in fact, a Pan-Africanist. But what about the fact that you happen to come from the Oromia state, or you have happened to be from the Oromo community? As we talk, you have an Oromo president, an Oromo prime minister,
yes,
an Oromo foreign minister. Is that correct?
Yes.
And in more than 2,000 years, no one has ever come from that community to be at the political helm of Ethiopia. How does that feel to you?
I think, you know, the difference now, of course, is that these people are self-identifying as Oromos, and they are fighting for Oromo rights. They are fighting for Oromos representation in the federal government, which has not been the case before. So in some ways, it shows just how much Ethiopia has changed from the hegemonic nation where ethnic identity is repressed and people have to conform to one national identity. I think it's good for Ethiopia because it's a diverse nation of 80 plus ethnic groups. And again, I'm not going to, I don't advocate for a dominance of one group over the other. It has to be, everyone has brings something to the table. And it has to be a fair share of the pie. And that's essentially what people have been asking. So the Oromo people, the Oromo struggle is not really about give us preferential treatment, give Oromos preferential treatment, or give us the key offices of the government to the Oromo. But since Oromia provides so much by the virtue of its geography, which occupies nearly half of the country,
right.
but also by the virtue of its demography,
population,
yeah. they need equal representation and fair share in the economy and want to benefit
from proportional representation, because what about the smaller groups?
That is something that needs to change. I think if Ethiopia is to continue as a more perfect union, as a more stable country, as a country that can continue to build on the economic progresses that we have seen over the last two decades, I think it has to be a fair share of the political power and also of the economy. People need to feel the dividends trickling down to the grassroots. The farmers should see benefits of the economy, not just the few who are connected to power, who gets these land deals and massive investment deals, or foreign investors who are being given massive amounts of land at a very dirt cheap, and they produce food and export it to, you know, Arab countries and Gulf nations where the people of Ethiopia continue to beg for food handouts. So these things that need to change, and I think for that to happen, I think they need to realize that one cannot be done without the other. So political freedom and then also economic development needs to go hand in hand.
Socioeconomic justice.
Yes.
Let's try to be a little bit more democratic and be inclusive. Let's go to the lifeline of the show, which are the telephone callers. Good evening, Samuel from Uganda. You're most welcome to Straight Talk Africa.
Good evening, Ndugu Shaka. How are you after a long, long time?
I'm hugely terrific. How are you?
I'm fine, and I've tried to invest my time. You know, I couldn't get you, and I say Happy New Year to the whole staff of VOA.
Thank you very much, and the same to you, of course. What is your question? You have 1 minute, because there are so many people in the queue.
Right. I take this question to Mustafa White. Why do we have 90% of results in Africa, and why are we seeing the shifting of political goalposts and disrespect of constitutionalism? When shall we have proper election results and equal opportunities for the opposition in Africa? What is there in Europe and other international democracies that is not in Africa? What is your take, the panelists? Thank you, Shaka. And I take this opportunity to say Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you too, though belatedly, Sam. Let's go to Okulu from Nigeria. Okulu, good evening, Okulu. You're most welcome straight to Africa.
To our guest, Mr. Adiza.
Patrick.
In Africa today, there are security reports people post into the internet, go WhatsApp and YouTube. At the end of the, and this security report they are posting, there are a lot of lapses. At the end, the security agencies don't take correction of those things. Well, what do we say at the last? All those people are posted on the WhatsApp and the YouTube now come back to be a reality. Why is this so? Our security agencies in Africa. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Would you like to react to the questions, Mustafa?
Sure. The first question, I didn't get a second question clearly, but to the first caller there, the difference really is about institutions. In the West, in countries where we've lived, like the United States, the institutions are strengthened.
How do you build these institutions? Because the people that are in positions of building them, they actually destroy the ones that they find there because they really want to end up as institutions themselves.
Right. You see, when in the case of Sierra Leone, when President Nkrumah, who is the outgoing president, came to power, the first thing he wanted to do, introduce in Sierra Leone, was attitudinal change. And I was very excited when I heard about that because I think that's the first thing that we need to do as people. We need to change our attitudes towards how we view governance, how we view government, and how we hold our governments accountable, how political parties, the expectations of being as a member of a political party, what do you expect, the rule of law and things like that. So for institutions to operate independently, the tone at the top is very important. I think the president of a country has, you know, there are a lot of times there's time for politics. When elections are over, it's time to govern. Mm. And the strategy for the two must be really different. Because in politics during elections, there are a lot of things that happen that are not so honest, not so credible. But when you are governing, you cannot govern with the same strategy. You have to tell people, if you're in charge of this institution, you have roles and responsibilities, there are mission statements, there are targets that are established, and let them operate independently. But if people are paying their political hunger zone by giving their political party members, people that were with them the whole time, and probably 10 years, you know, without a job, and they're waiting for that time to take over power, mm-hmm. and you look the other way when they are not doing what they're supposed to do, then it becomes a breakdown in the institutions. And once institutions are broken down, then we really can't get the sort of outcome we expect. You know, there are places where people get sacked because they fail to do what the person that appointed them put them in the office for. So people should really feel free to operate within the bounds of the confines of the appointment, and those institutions should be strengthened. And we really need to have a separation of power in Africa where the executive and the judiciary and the legislative are really independently operating. I mean, that will allow more of these institutions to work. You know, we need stronger institutions as opposed to stronger men.
So what would you say to Egypt, for example, General al-Sisi? I mean, this is a man who overthrew a democratically elected president, Morsi. In fact, the first in Egyptian history to be democratically elected. He's right now in prison.
Right.
And el-Sisi says he got 97%. Is it possible that, in fact, even if it was Prophet Muhammad running, he would actually garner 97%?
That is quite impossible, and it's been laughed at for the most part. I've been reading on it around.
So why do you have observers, for example, both local and international observers, well, in such an election, really? Such a facade.
Right, but you have to keep in mind the observers are very limited. Like the election that just took place in Sierra Leone, they had about 11,000 polling stations, and you have observers. I'm sure that's.
But at least you have elections there.
Right.
But let's face it, really. Who are the primary stakeholders in Africa? Is it the Africans, or is it, in fact, the development partners?
Well, I mean, it's an argument that you can make. But I've seen places like, you know, in the case of Egypt, a lot of people have been questioning the elections that took place there, 90%, like you mentioned, to the extent that, in fact, there's a report that the Electoral Commission had threatened to fine people if they didn't vote. And a lot of, you know, the invalid votes were more than the second, the person that came third. So they had 7 million invalid votes, and the person that came, you know, second candidate actually got 2%.
So the results probably are not necessarily reflections in fact of who voted, but rather who probably announces the results.
Correct. So,
well, you know, the last question, time is not obviously our best ally. Yeah. What do we learn really from Botswana? Look at Botswana.
Again, you know, I think Botswana provides a very good example of a country that had a very positive economic and political trajectory for very long. But the longer you stay, it comes with a fatigue, and they will come a fatigue. And I think, but still, I think the people are hopeful that the transition, even though it was not election, it will lead to eventually a more democratic election. Even though, as we've seen in other places and the callers rightly pointed out, the results are almost always predetermined where these establishment figures are put forward. But ultimately, it's a positive. I hope it will end with a positive result.
Botswana is unique in Africa because whereas there are many Africans who don't want to leave statehouse, in Botswana, they actually leave even 1 year before the end of their term.
Yes. Right.
Well, on that note, our guests are Mustapha Wai and Mohamed Ademo. Thanks to our feature stations, along with our viewers and listeners, for many of our Voice of America radio affiliates, Learning English is coming up next. And tomorrow morning, it's Daybreak Africa with James Bate. On behalf of the Voice of America, thanks for tuning into Straight Talk Africa. In the meantime, get better, not bitter, African transitions. And please remember to keep the African hopes alive.